I mean, ugly crying, lost it. It was it came out of fucking nowhere.
Welcome to Made Us. I am your host, Zach Weaver. Returning this week is the host of Truth and Justice, Mr. Bob Ruff. Bob recently got to do something that many of us won't ever get to do, so I wanted to bring him on here and talk about it, because honestly, I wanted to hear about it too, but I wanted all the listeners to hear about it. And what am I talking about? Bob recently got done filming a TV show. Who the hell does that? That's fucking awesome. So in this episode, Bob goes through every step of this process, from pitching it to filming it and editing it, and the pains that come along with it. Some of the recent episodes have been really deep and a little dark. Even though they're humorous, they still had some dark moments. So this week, I really wanted to bring you something a little more lighthearted. And that's why I brought Bob on, was to talk about this experience that he's had. And I, for one, thought it was really interesting. As you'll hear in the episode, we don't actually know when the show is going to be released. But as soon as we find out, I'll let all the listeners know. So again, this episode's a little different than normal. But if you like this episode, share it with a friend. Sharing the show with a friend really helps the show grow, and it's the biggest way to support the show. Also, if you want to support the show, go on to Apple Podcasts, leave us a 5-star rate and review, and subscribe to the show. And in the meantime, if you want to keep up with me on social media, you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/madeuspodcast, or on Instagram and Twitter at madeuspodcast. And if you have a guest suggestion, drop us a line at madeuspodcast@hotmail.com. And at the end of the episode, we talk a little bit about my new role with Truth and Justice, where I'll be stepping in weekly on the Friday follow-ups to help co-host the show with Bob Ruff. So if you're not sick of hearing me yet, you can hear me twice a week now, once on Thursdays and once on Fridays. So I really got to thank Bob for taking the time to do this interview with me again. We had a really good time going over this step-by-step and had a laugh. So if you guys want to hear a little more behind the scenes about Truth and Justice, this is the episode for you. So here's my conversation with Mr. Bob Ruff. Bob, welcome.
Oh, that's it? That's how we start?
Yeah, well, I record an intro on my own.
Thanks, Zach.
Jesus Christ. Here we go. It's going to be one of these nights.
Well, I didn't know we started yet.
Yeah. So I wanted to bring you on tonight because you recently got to do something that many of us will never get to do, which is record a TV show, and not only record a TV show, but kind of be the spotlight of the TV show.
Yeah, it was a scary experience preparing for it. It turned out to be not as bad as I thought it was going to be in some aspects, and way worse in other aspects.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
So you've been on TV other times. If my listeners don't know by now, go back, listen to episode 10 of Made Us with Bob Ruff. You can listen to Truth and Justice with Bob Ruff. You can get a feel for who he is. But most of my listeners by now know who you are.
Right.
So you've been on TV a few other times.
Yeah, I've been on, I've been on a lot of local news stuff.
Yeah, let me stop. I've been on TV before, but right. You've been on real TV before.
Right. I was, my first time on like a big show was, I was on a Discovery ID special on the Anand Syed case. And that one, where did I go? I flew to Baltimore.
Okay.
For that one. And that was a cool experience. It's very cool just being a guest.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little weird. You know, that one, you know, they flew me out there. And now that was... You know, at that point, I'm a year into podcasting. You know, nobody knows. It's like a year earlier, I'm a fireman that no one knows. And now they're flying me to Baltimore to go be on this TV show. So I thought I was hot shit. You know, I got there. Yeah. And then when they pick you up in the airport in a hired car, you know, this black SUV and the fancy driver drives you there, you really feel like hot shit. And you feel like hot shit right into the moment when they say, okay, we're going to get you down into makeup. And it's like, like, wait, what? You're going to take me into what? So got to wear a little makeup. But yeah, that was the experience. Anybody that ever does anything like that, you'll see that it tends to be frustrating and disappointing if you don't know how it works. And I didn't,
because
I sat down and did a 3-hour interview.
Jeez.
And I thought it was pretty solid. Actually, the producers liked the interview a lot, so much so that they then flew here to my home in Michigan to film me here because they wanted me to be a big feature in the story. And then they ended up, the network, kind of the way it was described to me, kind of gutted the show.
Yikes.
And they wanted it to be, they didn't think there was enough backstory.
Okay.
So in an hour-long episode, they wanted to originally make the first act, which is your first 6-7 minutes, to be the backstory and then talk about the new investigation, which was a lot of me. It turns out they ended up doing the first 5 acts or 4 acts of the backstory, and then they had like 12 minutes to fit all these interviews in. So I was like actually on the show for about a minute and a half, I think.
Wow. So 3 hours worth of interview for quote unquote 12 minutes here. That's
for quote unquote a minute and a half.
Oh, wow.
I was on for like a minute and a half the whole, cause they interviewed a bunch of people.
Okay.
You know, so, but it was cool that, you know, it was neat to sit down with my kids and they got to watch dad on TV. And then I did, I mean, before that I did a special for Vice News.
Okay.
They were just kind of followed me around for a day.
That's more of an internet thing, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was their like Vice News Daily type of thing on the internet. And then, it was just last year I went up to New York and was on the Grace versus Abram show on A&E, which was a neat experience.
Let me tell you something about that. It's on Hulu. You can go find it.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. I tried to watch it. I lasted about 10 minutes and I had to turn it off. I could no longer take Nancy Grace.
Nancy's tough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was shot weird. I wasn't happy with the way it was shot.
Honestly, that was my biggest issue with it. You know, they edited the piss out of it.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be one of these live to tape shows, right? So it's supposed to be like a live studio audience, and it was, but you know, it airs 3 weeks later. So they edit it. And they edited it so much that even as a consumer, even if it wasn't me or a case I cared about, it was just hard to watch. It was
yeah, it
so
was really
clunky.
Hard to watch.
And I think a lot of it was, matter of fact, I turned down to be on another Nancy Grace show. She's got a new show coming out on Oxygen, which is the network I'm going to be on. Where she's taking a second look at the cases that haunt her.
Okay.
Essentially, to me, it seems like she's trying to rebrand, realizing that, you know, being the mean lady prosecutor is not popular, and everybody's about these wrongful conviction cases, and so she's doing this one. They were looking at doing the Melgar case, and both Liz and I were very hesitant about it. I think they ended up dropping that case from their docket. But yeah, that show was. It was a little nerve-wracking. You know, they brought us out and we sat in front of an audience, and it was like supposed to be like a debate show. And it was I thought it went really well in the moment. I did find out Nancy Grace's persona is exactly that. You know, when the cameras would cut and the commercial breaks, she would be, you know, come over and, oh, it's so nice to meet you, and it's so great. She's the sweetest lady in the world. You know, so it was kind of an act.
She had that professional wrestler act going on.
Yeah, exactly. We did the show, and what I found is she knows nothing about these cases.
Really?
So she's trying to debate the Anand Syed case, which I knew very, 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 very thoroughly.
Yeah.
And I came, and the producers, like, came into my green room beforehand and were... Now, we want you to. This show was kind of failing. They wanted it to be this hot debate, but she is so loud. Nancy is so loud and obnoxious that no one would tangle with her.
Yeah, she's very overpowering.
Yeah, so people would start talking and she would overpower them and they would just sit back. And so that was one of the reasons they wanted me there, because they thought I had a personality that could give them what they were looking for, which was this, you know, back and forth, you know, and really debate. And that's what they got. But when that happens and one of the people in the argument doesn't know the case at all, it got ugly. I mean, to the point where like the studio audience was laughing at her, you know, at some time, because she would make, I mean, I came out swinging because they told me like jump. They literally had a producer in the back of the room holding up a sign that said jump in.
Really?
Yeah. And so when she'd be talking, if they got any inclination from looking at me that I was like, I'm, you know, I have something to say about that, they're holding up a sign going, jump in. They wanted that kind of conflict. And so in her opening monologue, I'm sitting backstage before they introduce me, and she says just a whole bunch of ridiculous shit that was not accurate at all about Anand, about the case, about Hay. And so they brought me out in the opening moments, which of course they cut, didn't make it. I mean, she's like,
yeah, it was really confusing. When I watched it, they had the opening bit and then they went to a commercial break. And then when they came back from the commercial break, you're on stage,
right?
But they don't address who you are in the show for like 2 minutes of you sitting there.
They couldn't, because they cut. What I'm told was that Nancy had final cut rights in her contract.
Okay.
And it looked terrible, because I mean, I walked out and she's like, well, everybody, this is Bob Ruff, and Bob, you know, he hosts the podcast Truth and Justice, and how you doing, Bob? I said, well, first of all, I would like to address everything you just said. First of all, that is incorrect. That is incorrect. That is incorrect. And she said, well, I have the, I said, you got the documents right there. Show me in that document where it says what you just said, because that was bullshit. And she's like, oh, well, I'll just look through that. And that's how it started. I mean, yeah. That was out of the gate. And they told, and I, that's not my personality. You yeah. know me. Like, oh, I, yeah. You know, I if I'm going to argue, I want to, you know, keep things calm and try to get each other to see eye to eye. But they told me, they're like, just get into it. And it was kind of infuriating what she was saying. So that's why the opening scene of that was there. I'm just there. There's no introduction because it all blended. They couldn't cut it around because in the middle of her talking, I'm like, look, woman, you are wrong.
That's awesome.
But the whole thing was like that. There was a few times where I was making a point. And they would look like mid sentence, like Nancy says something, I'm making a point, and then you watch me kind of like, I know that specifically there's one scene where you see me kind of like raise my hand and I'm kind of putting my finger down on the table
yeah.
to continue my point. And it's like I raise my hand and then come down and cut to Nancy standing in the audience talking to someone. Like they just
I don't think I made it that far then.
Oh, it's terrible. They butchered it. So again, like it wasn't like I came out looking bad in the whole thing. It was just it was stupid. It was a waste of my time in the production.
Yeah, I was really disappointed with the production of it.
Mm-hmm. And the other episodes of it weren't like that, but it was nobody was arguing with her.
Yeah.
But again, it was a cool experience. They flew me out to New York City, and I stayed in Manhattan. And I think I went and had dinner with Damien Eccles and Lori while I was there, Lori Davis's wife. So it was cool to, you know, got to go to New York. My small town ass got to go to New York and again, get, you know, carted into the fancy hotel and then out to the fancy
you get to feel special studio. For a minute.
Yeah. So it was kind of cool. I had my own green room, which nobody, there was one green room for all the guests and then a separate green room for just me, which I found out was so that the producers could come back in there and
rile you up.
Yeah. Rile me up and get my boxing gloves on before we went out. But that was all cool. But both of those were one day events, you know, fly out, land, you know, go to a hotel, do the taping, sleep in a fancy hotel and fly home the next day. But since getting this show picked up with, I mean, I really shied away from, you'll find anybody, and it's nothing special with me, but anybody that has a popular podcast, I think in any realm, especially in true crime, you have TV producers knocking on your door all the time. Not literally emailing yeah. you is what's happening. But I would get those all the time. I would get the, you know, people like, hey, and of course I didn't know how the industry worked then. Right. So somebody like, I'm a producer with Netflix and I want to make a TV show about truth and justice.
And I'd be like, hell yes, let's do this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, at first I was like,
but
cool,
you're smarter than me.
Yeah. Well, I was like, cool. I'll talk to you. And then I talked to him. I was like, yeah, we're doing this. And I'm like, so Netflix is green. Like, well, no, it's a process. And let me explain to all of you. So the first step of that process, this is how it may work. So for any of you are ever approached by somebody that wants to make a TV show, networks don't approach people to make TV shows.
Yes.
Producers do. Producers will then get you on board, and then they have to go out and there's a whole bunch of contract negotiations, and then you have to film a sizzle reel.
Okay.
You know, where they follow, which for me, we started this, you know, I told a bunch of producers no. John Cryer ended up reaching out to me and really wanted to do it. He flew me out to L.A. and I got to go meet with him and had some really funny moments for my little small town ass. I ran into Ryan Stiles. I saw Cato Kaelin, you know, I'm going to fucking sushi with John Cryer. You know,
yeah, that's pretty crazy.
Yeah, it was. It's insane that was happening to me. But then we went to the Warner Brothers studio, who he was contracted with at the time, and pitched him the idea. And they said, yeah, let's go with it. Let's make a sizzle.
Okay.
So they bankrolled that. So then.
And what's a sizzle?
So a sizzle reel is like a trailer. You know, like when you're watching a trailer on TV, what it is, it's the tool to try to convince the network to buy your show.
Okay.
You know, so I was at that time I was investigating Ed's case, and we were trying to do the show with Ed's case. And so I already had a trip to Tyler planned.
Okay.
When John needed me to come out there. So I just piggybacked them together. So I went from here to LA, then LA to Dallas. Well, Warner Brothers greenlit it, so they sent a camera crew with us down to Dallas. So they followed me around for a couple days in Dallas. Then there was another trip to Dallas where they followed me around. They filmed all this stuff. And then just like, I wish I still had it. You know, they put together a kick-ass movie trailer to try to pitch Ed's case.
Yeah.
And so once they do all that, and that's months, then you schedule appointments, not me, John probably.
Yeah.
Schedule appointments with all these networks, and then you go have these meetings with them in their pitch meetings, and you sit with a group of people who have no emotions and or hearts, I don't think. And you explain to them, we'd like to make this show, and this is what it's about, and we kind of pitch the whole thing. And then you show them your tape. This is a reel, the 3 to 5 minute little trailer thing. and then you wait to hear back from them.
Okay.
And so we went. I went out to LA again. I was there for like a week. And we pitched it to several different networks. Oxygen was one of them. And we had good pitches. I don't know how they normally go, but I know ours, we were in the room for like an hour every time.
It seems like it's going well.
Yeah. And they said that in that process, normally, like, these people don't fuck around. Like, okay. They don't have time. Like, if they don't want, if they're not interested, they will literally stop you in the middle of your sentence and tell you to get out.
Yeah.
You know, and that never happened to us. You know, we put all our time in. We've got a bunch of what they call soft passes, which is, we like it, we don't have a slot for it right now, and we like the concept, but maybe a different case. We don't know if there's enough assets with this case.
It's not you, it's me.
Yeah, kind of that kind of shit.
Yeah.
But you know, and that's how I felt about it. But they kept telling me, we need to keep pursuing this, because they don't do that. They don't give a shit about your feelings. If they didn't like it, they would just tell you, we don't like it. And I was the whole time really, really apprehensive about the whole thing, because I have a wife and four kids. And all I was thinking is, like, if we make this show, what does that look like? What does that mean? How long am I gone? Do I have to be on the road?
Yeah.
You know, and Becky and I are a blended family, so I have my kids every other week. So that schedule's not going to work, and that's a lot. I mean, for those of you that have kids every week, you know, like, yeah. You know, that's no big deal. But when that's your normal schedule, that's a lot for me to put on my ex to say, oh, by the way, for the next 2-3 months, whatever, you have the kids all the time.
Yeah.
You know, and you have stuff scheduled when you're not planning on doing that. So I was a little apprehensive about it. So John would call me and say, you know, it didn't go through, you know, we didn't get anybody yet, but we're going to keep trying and, you know, keep your chin up. And I just kept telling, like, John, you don't understand. I don't care. Like, and it wasn't to be a dick. It was just like, I have never been a person that, like, has desired to be on TV.
Yeah.
I think I have a face for radio. I was like, I didn't have any desire to do that. And I was like, and I feel like, and you know, I'm a bit spiritual myself. And I'm like, look, if this is supposed to happen, then it'll happen.
Yeah.
And if it's not, then it's not. And I'm going to be fine. I'm going to keep doing my thing. The contract expired with Warner. Nobody ended up buying the Ed H case for it. Well, then Ed got released. And Oxygen, I think, was kicking themselves in the ass, because they said, we love it, we love you, we love the concept, but these wrongful conviction cases, they take too long to unfold. Nothing's ever going to happen.
Yeah.
There's, what's going to be the conclusion? And had they been filming, they would have, that,
they Ed would have walking caught out, all of that.
Yeah.
And that was super emotional. I know there's footage of it somewhere, but I mean, that is just super emotional. That moment of him walking out and his son running across the road to him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
that's in, you're going to see that in the spoiler in the West Memphis 3 case,
I
in
bawled.
The backstory.
I bawled.
I did too. I bawled a lot during that. But so they missed that, and we kind of came to a point. It was the June before that, when John and I talked and we're like, look, you know, because we had like a 1-year contract with, between me and him and me and Warner Brothers. And he's like, listen, you're free to keep, you know, go with someone else and try to pitch this somewhere else, or we can try this some more, or we can go away. And I told John, it wasn't just because John Cryer is John Cryer. It's because when I met with John, his heart and intentions were in the right place.
Yeah.
John doesn't need unscripted TV money because I promise you, it's nothing like you expect. It's not very much money at all.
But he's got 2.5 men money.
He's got that 2.5 men money. Yeah. He got that ducky money still from Pretty in Pink, right? But he genuinely has a passion for what I do. You know, he's on the Undisclosed podcast too. Yep. You know, he's got a passion for that. And he's like, I think if we bring it to a larger audience, we can help some more people. We can bring it to a greater awareness. We talked about what we wanted the show to look like and we're on the same page. And I just, and if anybody, I'm sure most people won't, but ever has the pleasure of meeting John Cryer, he is one of the most genuine, kind, honest guys that I've ever met. I met a lot of people out in Hollywood over the last couple of years, and John is by far the one that I trust to no end. You know,
yeah, that's really cool. Especially at that level, that's really cool to meet somebody that's still that down to earth.
He's such an amazing and a humble guy, and we had some funny stories along the pitch process. So you'd never know, of all the people making the rounds to these meetings, right? All the partners that are going to make the rounds to the pitch meetings. John most certainly has more money than any of them.
Yeah.
John, they're all driving their Lexuses and their BMWs, and they almost all, half of them have Teslas, their big fancy cars. And John drives a Chevy Volt. just very, very humble. You could tell. I mean, I don't know his personal finances, but just from I've had dinner with him and his kids, and just smart with his money. He's not that rock star guy. You know, he's just a smart, good guy. But we actually pulled up to a meeting at HBO, and I was riding with his wife, actually, Lisa, in her Tesla. Oh, and then I get out, and everybody's getting out, and we hear John arguing with the valet guy. and the last thing I heard was John go, "I'm John fucking Cryer." I'm like, "What is going on?" And then goes, and he gets out of the car, and he pulled up, and he's like, "Damn it, that happens too often." He's like, "What?" He's like, "They thought I was an Uber driver." Because he's driving a Chevy Volt. So he pulled up and they're like, "Sir, the Uber's over there." And he's like, "I'm not an Uber. I have a meeting. Sir, Ubers are over there." Because nobody probably ever pulled up there in a Chevy Volt before.
Exactly.
And he's like, "I'm not an Uber driver. I have a meeting in HBO headquarters up there." Like, "Sir," and that's when we all heard the, "I'm John fucking Cryer."
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah. But, you know, so we got to that point, and John was, you know, "Whatever you want to do," you know, and he did so much. I mean, everything. Like, the only reason I didn't get screwed out of any of these deals, too, is because he told me, like, when his company, Discount Sushi, is his production company, sent me a contract.
That's the name of his company, is Discount Sushi?
Discount Sushi. It's a story about his first date with his wife.
Oh, boy.
He was taking her somewhere, and she said, "I don't go for Discount Sushi. We're going to go somewhere nice." And so their company name is Discount Sushi.
All right. I like it.
Yeah. But we went, we sent the contract, and I said, "I'll look at it," and I have a lawyer here that's going to look at it. And he's like, "Dude, you need an agent and an entertainment lawyer. Let me," and you can't just get that. You know, you don't just call up and "I would like you to represent me." They don't do that.
Yeah.
Like, you got to, like, send headshots and all this bullshit to get an agent. I don't know how.
I would be totally lost in this.
Yeah, I have no idea how any of that works. The only reason I have an agent is because John fucking Cryer called United Talent Agencies and said, "Hey, we need you to assign someone to represent him. He's entering into a contract with us, and we want to make sure he's represented." So he took care of that for
me. That's a good phone call to have, though.
Yeah, and he could have let me just get screwed. I mean, the contract wasn't any intention to screw me, but you know, he helped me out there. But so anyway, jumped to a year later, and you know, I told him, I was like, "John, I've told you from the beginning, I have no desire to be on TV. I'm not doing this for any other reason other than I think that it would be great to bring in a larger audience in order to try to push our cause forward and try to reform the system. And I'm not doing this with anyone but you. I don't care who it is, you and me, like, ride or die. If either I'm doing it with you or I'm not doing it." And he's like, "Well, then let's make it happen." And it's funny because I'm leaving tomorrow. Anyway, I'm going to the Beachbody Summit, which Becky and I go to every year. And I was at the Beachbody Summit talking to John about this. I guess it would have been 2017 at that point. And I told him, I was like, "You know who we should bring in? Is another very good friend of mine is Jim Clementi."
Yeah.
And Jim is not only is the, you know, the criminal behavior analyst and the writer of Criminal Minds, but he keeps making the shit out of some TV shows.
He's made some really cool stuff, actually.
Manhunt Unabomber, The Case of JonBenet Ramsey.
I was hesitant on the Manhunt Unabomber thing. I love some true crime stuff.
Uh-huh.
I don't like docudrama stuff.
Right. It was a scripted series.
I want documentaries.
Right.
And I love that stuff. And I was very interested in the Unabomber. I've always been very interested in the Unabomber. So the very first time I turned it on, watched about 4 seconds and turned it off.
Oh, this is some scripted thing.
Because it was like, "Oh, this is some scripted crap. I don't want to watch this." And then I believe you actually talked me into watching it.
It's so good.
And it was so good.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it was really, really good.
Yeah. And so it was, so that and other shows. So, you know, I told John, I was like, "Jim and I are friends. We work together constantly. Jim's kind of a mentor to me. He teaches me a lot. And then he comes on our show and I go on his show." And I was like, "Why don't," and he has his own production company called XG Productions.
Okay.
And I said, why don't we bring Jim on board?" I said, "One thing Jim does know for sure is how to sell a TV show, because he's selling them."
Yeah. So you're accidentally building like a powerhouse team.
Right. Yeah. Oh, and by the way, John brought in, because we needed a physical production entity, which is like someone that actually has the building and the staff to edit TV shows. So he had connections and brought in Mark Herzog and Herzog and Company, which most, if you're really into TV, you know who that is. Yeah. If you're not, you don't. But they're powerhouses when it comes to documentaries. They did the Decade series on CNN.
Yeah.
All of those. Mark Herzog's office is full of Emmys from one end to the other from That's all the amazing. Shows they've done. Yeah, they're big time. So they were already our partners. So now we go in with NBI Studios. John Cryer's Discount Sushi. We have Herzog, and we bring in XG. You know, so we have, you know, we have FBI people on board. We've got the podcast person on board. We've got the TV people on board, and like some of the best documentary producers in the world on board. And we go around and we make it, and we decide we're gonna try to pitch it, because I was getting ready to start the West Memphis 3 case at that point. And we decide, well, let's pitch this one.
Yeah,
you know, that's it. Because what I thought, they were talking, what other cases could we do? Let's get something fresh, whatever. And
which had to be a hard pitch, because that case at that point, I don't want to say it had been beaten to death, but it almost felt like it had been beaten to death.
Yeah,
there's four documentaries out on it, on top of TV shows and everything else,
books and everything else. Yeah, it really had been beaten to death. And the only reason we went with that case was because I told him, like, I can't, when I commit to a case on the podcast, that gets 100% of my time, attention, and resources.
Yeah.
And we were getting ready to launch into that. I'm like, I can't, because they were talking about maybe picking another case. And I was like, I can't.
Oh, they were going to try to make you do two cases. Basically, you were going to do one case for the podcast, and they were going to try to make you do a separate case for the
podcast. Well, that's the idea that they had, was let's find another case that we could do. And I was like, I can't do that. I can't research another case thoroughly enough to even do the sizzle reel and still do Truth and Justice at the same time.
Yeah.
And still do my case. So I said, why don't we just pitch it with West Memphis 3? And that was the same thing. It's been done so much. How can we do it? I said, well, I think I've got a different angle on it. You know, I want to investigate. I don't want to investigate the conviction of the West Memphis 3. I want to investigate the murders of Stevie, Michael, and Christopher.
Yeah. Which honestly had been forgotten. I mean, I know we'll get to that. But it really been forgotten, because 2011 was when the West Memphis 3 were released, and they just, I don't want to say everybody gave up, but basically everybody gave up, because that had been the cause for so long, was getting
those
three.
That was the
goal. Was getting those three home, even though, you know, it had started to find the murderers, but it was getting those three home. And when those three came home, people kind of...
There were still like these underground movements and like Facebook profile, you know, groups that doing stuff. And Jason Baldwin still, you know, he's working with Proclaim Justice, nonprofit, with John Harden, another attorney and investigator, and they're working with other people, and they've wanted to keep going, but they don't have the resources anymore.
Yeah.
You know, once they got out, you don't have Eddie Vedder and Johnny Depp writing checks anymore. You know, they did all that. And seemingly they had maybe tested everything they could test, and, you know, they've accomplished their goal. And, you know, Jason is ready to fight. And then, you know, and I've seen people on the other side of that argument, the what they call them, the nons, that think that they're guilty. You're like, oh, yeah, they said they were going to find somebody, you know, they're going to find out who did it, and it scorched earth, and they're not doing shit. All they're doing, it's like, do you understand that they have to live their life? Like, what do you expect them to do?
Yeah.
Nobody's writing them checks. They have to live a life. They have to earn a living. As Damien told me the first time I talked to him, he's like, people think I share a joint checking account with Johnny Depp, and I don't. It's not like that at all. Yeah. It's like, you know, I gotta earn a living, and I gotta, you know, he lives in friggin' Manhattan, in Harlem, and it's not cheap. But anyway, so we get into that, and we start pitching the sizzle for that, and I go do a few interviews and start to investigate. I'm doing stuff on the podcast, and then we went around to do another round of pitching in the middle of that season on the podcast. So I'm about halfway through the first half of that season when we went back to LA and started doing our pitches again, another round.
Yep.
And we went into the same places, and this time the response was much different. We were immediately getting back, like, we're interested.
That's awesome.
The pitch meetings, some of the meetings were going over an hour. We had people captivated, which was amazing, because we're talking about a case that had already been done so many times. So their initial reaction was, what are you going to do different? But we came right out like, this is what we're going to do differently, and this is how we're going to put it together, and showed them the sizzle, and one after another, they were interested. I was actually at CrimeCon last year on the day I gave, on the 25th anniversary of the boys' deaths.
Yeah.
And I gave a speech there, did a presentation, and after my presentation, Corey Abrams, who is the creative person from Oxygen that was in that meeting, came up and talked to me. I didn't know she was there. And she's like, oh, that was amazing. And she said, we're making an offer. We're buying the show.
That's great.
And I was like, what? And I was like, right there. And like, but you can't tell anybody. Like, oh, shit. Well, what do I say? So then I was in a little bit of a dilemma, because I had, part of the agreement was I had to stop producing the podcast, because we had to save that new investigation for the TV
show.
But I also have NDAs in place that say I can't tell anyone I'm making a fucking TV show.
So you can't just drop it.
Right.
And so, say, hey, we're making a TV show. We'll come back.
I was so careful with my words. Like, there's been a development.
Uh-huh.
And so we are going to pause and we're going to come back. And it was a development deal. It says it right on my contract. There's a development deal. And there was some other stuff that was going on that'll be revealed in the TV show. But so that was exciting. And then the contract negotiations start. And there's that goes on and on and on and on and on all the way through the fall and into this winter. And then we finally got that all settled. And then about January, we were like, everything was in the books.
Yeah.
Like, we need to hire a showrunner. And so they all went through a list and interviewed some people and then picked the person that they thought was best. So
what's a showrunner do? I've heard the term before, but I don't fully know what they do.
They yell at people. So Dominique Hoffman is our showrunner.
Yep.
Or I guess her official title is executive producer, just like me.
Okay.
She seemed more like a director. Basically, she's the head person in charge of everything. So she sets, where we're going to be, when we're going to be there. Now, there's a whole team under her. There's a Nick Van Dam is a guy. I told him if I ever talk about this, he'll get credit because these guys never get credit. He's he's the production coordinator and works his ass off. So it's like when Dominique's like, okay, tomorrow, and there's like several producers under Christina Bichet, Bichal, I always get her last name wrong, Matt Graham, a couple of producers that they're creating the story and storyboard, kind of like I have going on here, storyboarding, like planning out what are these episodes going to look like and what are we going to do. And then once they say that they were run up by Dominique, Dominique's like, okay, well, let's on this day, we're going to interview these two people. Then that goes to Nick and Natalia Henderson, another person that worked for him. I told them all, I mentioned him by name one time. This is your place. I'll direct them to this episode. But then they schedule it and figure out how to pay for it and get all the crew there. Cause we have a crew of about 15 people.
Yeah.
The cameraman and everything. And, they arrange all that. And then once we show up, Dominique's the one calling the shots.
Okay.
So she's, okay, I want cameras here. And it's an interesting thing because everybody is an expert in their own place.
Yeah.
But she's still the one that has to make the final decision about what the show looks like. So, for example, our camera, we had two different DPs, which are director of photography, your head camera person.
Okay.
I can't remember her last name, Anne, but she's amazing. She was awesome. She kind of set the style for the show, which is very unique.
Yeah.
Nothing you've ever seen on Oxygen before. Very high level, high class cinematography.
Yeah, I've been very fortunate to actually get to sneak a few peeks at it. Mm-hmm. And I really like the way it's insane, it was filmed, right? and the way it looks.
Yeah.
I think it's got a really nice look to it.
And that's all the DPs and Dominique. And so, and then for the second half of production, we had a guy named Matt Blute, who was one of the cameramen in the Transformers series.
So really?
He's filmed a lot of the Transformers movies. I think he was the head of the 3D cameras.
Wow.
But Dominique brought with her because she runs a show called Declassified on CNN.
Okay.
And that's a very well shot show. And she basically took her whole crew from there to this show.
Okay.
They said how they want to, but so like they'll set up a room and Matt and, the second camera, which was Rebecca in the first half and Dirk in the second half, they set up their camera and this is how I want it. And there's so much that goes into it. I could never even begin to understand everything from their aspect ratio to the filters, to the lighting, to the angles and which lens they're using. And they fit up and then Dominique are like, nope, I don't like that. I want this. I want this light here or this. And so, but they're the expert, right? So that's just kind of how it works. So that's why, I mean, she kind of yells at everybody all the time. She just wants to, it's their job to know the equipment and make it right and make it look good. And it's her job to look at that screen and decide like, no, that's not how I want the show to look. Or yes, that is how I want the show to look. And then she, she's the one that says, okay, let's go, let's roll. I always make fun of her through the whole process as we got to know each other from working together for 3 months straight. Her favorite line is let's go. Cause she's funny. She's a great person and she's funny to hang out with. But then she'll be like joking around with you and joking around with you. Then all of a sudden she'll be like, all right, let's go. Let's go. We're burning daylight. so that's what a showrunner does.
Okay.
And so that happened in about January. They had me interview her and she was very crass and I loved her.
Yeah.
And I was like, when she's talking to me, she's like, she doesn't mince words. She's a no bullshit kind of woman. And I'm like, yep, she's it.
That's perfect.
Yeah. I like her. She's going to get the job done. And so then it was like, okay, so when are we going to film? Oh, we're probably filming middle of summer, blah, blah, blah. And it's going to be this long or this long. And I kept asking, how long of a process is this? Like, I have kids. I can't be gone forever.
Yeah.
And they, all of a sudden they're like, we're starting next week.
Whoa.
In February.
That's quick.
We started the day after my birthday. It was the first day of pre-production. I had to fly out there for a week to do all the storyboarding and stuff with the myself and the other two, Matt and Christina, the producers, figuring out like what the story looks like, what we're going to do, what the plan is, to get ready for production.
You're about there for like a week. Is that what you said?
Yeah. So there was a week or so I had to go and do pre-production stuff. And then I got to come home for a week and then it was like go time. And now they told me that it's not going to be that bad. Dominic's like, I don't like to do things in long stretches.
Okay.
You know, so like you'll be here for 2 weeks. We'll give you a week off. You're here for 3 weeks. We'll give you a week off. We'll give you a week, back and forth. Basically, we had 24 days of filming in the budget.
Okay.
So that's how that works from the network. The network, they'll negotiate a whole budget. How much is it going to cost for every day you film? And we're going to budget this many days for you to film. So those 24 days end up being spread out over 3 months.
Okay. Well, that doesn't sound, I mean, at this point, it doesn't sound terrible.
No, I didn't think so either.
Yeah.
Like, it's not going to be bad, babe. I'm going to go for, I'll be gone for a couple of weeks. I'll be home. Then I'll go. But it was rough.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, it was rough, because at that point, I thought everything was going to be fine. And it was fine. I mean, it was as good as it could be. I had a great experience. Thank God I had amazing people. All those people I just named, along with, a ton of other people, Drew, our AC, and Mariel, our sound guy, and Megan, our one of the, what is she, production manager, coordinator, something like that, that gets our craft service and all. The whole crew, we traveled all over together, were just awesome people, just amazing people. We had fun. We laughed a lot. It was fun on set.
That's good.
Until Dominique said, let's go, and the fun was over.
Then it was over.
There was also fireworks. I mean, there were times where there was screaming and yelling and fighting, and Dominique warned me about that before we went. She's like, we're going to be family by the time this is over.
Yeah.
Like, we are both making, she's like, my name is all over this, and this is your name and your brand, and we both want it to be just right, and we may not see eye to eye, and this could get, because I am the executive producer also.
Okay.
And so I have more control over what goes into it than, say, even John Cryer, who is an executive producer, but he's up. He's in an office somewhere. He's not down. He's not on the, he's not in the suck with the rest of us, down there doing the work. And there were moments like that, but man, I tell you what, the travel, it got to me in way one that was the most noticeable. I gained 24 pounds over the course of this.
Wow.
And I still have not recovered from it. I'm trying and I can't come back.
I didn't realize that.
It's a combination of things. So when you're filming, when you're in that industry, your days are 12-hour days.
Yeah.
And that's 12-hour days from go time till not. Now, I sort of, and because I'm it's my show.
Yeah.
So I'm in literally every scene. So when we had early call times, like 6 a.m. call time, literally everyone but me could roll out of bed. There were days like, Matt, he's got to be a really good friend of mine. One of the producers was like, oh God, I haven't showered or shaved in 2 days. Like, these hours are killing me. And I'm like, must be nice, because I had to be here at 6 also, except for I have to be on fucking camera, which means I've got to get up in time to take a shower and shave and put on my clothes, take my 5-eye outfits so that Dominique can tell me what to wear. That's that's also what the showrunner does.
Okay.
Every day. Did you ever watch Heartbreak Ridge?
Yes.
So, they came out every day with their shirts that they were going to wear, and if they didn't match or didn't have the right ones, Gunny made them take their shirt. That was my every single morning the show. I'm like, this one? She's like, nope. What the worst days were is where I ended in that shirt, because she'd be like, oh, what else you got?
Yeah.
What else you got?
I had a friend that was on a tattoo TV show. It was called Tattoo Nightmares. It was a cover-up TV show.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that. He showed up not knowing what was going on.
Yep.
And he got there and they're like, your clothes are all wrong.
Right.
And literally like gave him money to go to the store and like told him like, go buy this color and this and this, and they wouldn't film until that point.
Right. I had to go shopping with one of the PAs.
Really?
Eddie. Me and Eddie went to every, and I, so I'm a, for those that don't know what I look like, I'm a big guy. I'm a 2X shirt.
Yeah.
And I'm thick. So it's hard to, in LA, it's hard to go find nice clothes.
Yeah.
In my size. Nobody carries it, because apparently big fashion designers don't want big dudes wearing their clothes.
It makes sense.
But
I don't think it makes sense, but out there it makes sense.
Yeah. You'll see in the show, my narrative voice is done in an interview room. So there's like a repeating theme that where I move the story along, sitting in a dark room with a spotlight on me, which was hell. Yeah.
Which I know something about this too, that I'm afraid that I got you sick during this process, because I know at some point during filming you were sick as hell.
I was. I was, yeah.
Yeah. And I was sick as hell during all of that. So my fear is that I got you sick for that.
Shit, I didn't even think about that because it was at the same time. I was thinking of when we got off the cruise and I was fucked up.
But, oh, I blame it on that then.
But there was the coughing. I was coughing through half the freaking filming.
I blame it on that then.
Yeah. But so this you'll see when you watch the show.
Yeah.
Me and I'm wearing like this kind of blue denim kind of button up shirt. It's from Lucky. That's where we ended up finally finding one. With me and Eddie were shopping all day and like in a hurry with Dominique texting us, let's go, because we had, you know, you're on a time limit once it yeah. Because our crew wasn't union, but they still operate under union rules. So like if call time's six, they're on the clock at six.
Okay.
And you can't work them more than 6 hours until you give them lunch break. It doesn't matter if you're in the middle of a line. Noon comes, cut.
Really?
Lunch 30 minutes. And then we're back, and then you've got six more hours before you got to start paying overtime, and you're paying overtime to 15 people, you know, so it's a big deal.
I figured there would be some little bit of leniency.
There's no leniency. I mean, everything is a huge decision. Like if someone interview cancels and we decide that we need to move something up, so maybe we're going to move lunch, like that's a process. That's five phone calls and people figuring out what we can do, calling Natalia, can we afford to do this? Because that means, say we move up lunch up an hour.
Yeah.
You know, from 12:30 to 11:30. So they move it up to 11:30 to get that. So we're not wasting time because maybe an interview canceled or something. But then at 12, we're back.
Yeah.
And you still only have 6 hours on the other end. It's not 12 hours total. It's six lunch and six.
Okay.
So if you do five lunch and six, it's still overtime after that six.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so there's all these games that they're playing all the time, right? Or not overtime, but they have to feed them another meal after 6 hours, which is another whole production and everything.
Yeah.
But so, you know, we were running out to go shopping because they wanted the perfect shirt that fit the scene that they had put together. And I would never think of a denim shirt, but that's what ended up, and it looks great. But they, you know, there was all these people involved in this decision. And it was a torture chamber. So, you know, that wore me down bad. And it fucking, Dominique and I both learned our lesson after the first two times of doing like 6 hours in that thing.
Yeah.
That we have to break it up in smaller chunks because we were losing our fucking mind. So you've seen like when like old spy movies, when they shine the light in somebody's eyes.
Yeah.
To get them to talk. Well, that's a real thing. It's an actual thing. We actually have a special forces operator on the show.
Really?
That we were talking to about this. And he's like, it's a real fucking thing. You put somebody in a dark room and shine a light in their eyes for a long period of time, it fucks with their brain.
Really?
Yeah, and it psychologically, it just tears you down and just wears you out. And so the way this scene is set to make the lighting look right, I'm sitting in a chair in the middle of a dark room.
Yeah.
And there is a giant fucking light. I mean, like 4 foot by 4 foot light that you don't see on the camera that is 2 feet away from my head, shining at my face. I'm looking into... I can't remember what they call this thing, but it's something they use for teleprompters sometimes.
Okay.
But it's basically a periscope of mirrors. They wanted those interviews with me staring down the barrel of the camera, looking right to the audience. So they got these mirrors set up to where Dominique is sitting off camera, where I can't see her behind a wall like the Wizard of fucking Oz.
Yeah.
And she's looking into that thing, and so she's asking me questions, and I'm answering. And I look like I'm answering to her face, but I'm looking down the camera.
Okay.
Which gets
that's a pretty neat setup.
Yeah. And it was a cool effect. But so she had to have the same light in her eyes, too, for me to see her. Only lights on in the room. And it's nuts. So it's disorienting. I mean, I'm sitting in a completely pitch black room with a giant light in my eyes, looking at talking to a floating head.
Yeah.
In the middle of the room. And you're going to see me cry a lot on the show. Probably more than I'd like. I mean, some of that's just genuine. I mean, it's all genuine, but
yeah,
some of it is just things that I'm very emotional about. Other times it was just, you know, I miss my kid's birthday.
Oh, man.
And it was wearing me out. And on his birthday, I was there was a moment where I was talking about, I was telling a story in the interview room that I've told 100 times before.
Yeah.
And out of nowhere, I lost. And that's, I think, was part of that light and the exhaustion. And all the time on the road and airplanes and just everything all and being upset about that. It was like a 3 week, I'd been gone for 3 weeks straight and I'd missed my kid's birthday. And I was just talking about Ed Eights. And I think I was saying, like, you know, he missed the birth of his son and his daughter. You know, I've told that in a million interviews.
Yeah.
And it was like, he missed the birth of his son and lost it. Oh. I mean, ugly crying, lost it. And it was, it came out of fucking nowhere. But I mean, that's how emotionally drained I was through this process. I mean, I'm talking to families of murder victims.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so the work itself was very emotionally draining. The hours, like I said, oftentimes we had six. My call time is usually a little later. I might have to go in at 7.
Yeah.
But then you work a 12-hour shift, you know, you're 12 hours of filming and go back. And then, you know, that was, I think, part of the weight gain. They have, you know, they order you in food every day. You know, Nick would put out an email. This is where I'm ordering from today. What do you want? They bring in lunch. Then they have the craft services table, which has just snacks all over the place. And you just sit there and fucking just pick at snacks and eat, and you don't move. There's no, I didn't exercise at all.
Yeah.
You know, I went with, you know, I do the Beachbody on demand stuff. I'm like, I can knock out some Shaun T. Like, I'll hit 25 minutes in my hotel. I can do it on my phone, on the app on my phone every day.
Yeah.
I was so fucking exhausted by the time I got home, because it just wears you out. You know, and having to be on camera all the time, you can't disengage your brain for a minute. You know, you're engaged the whole time.
Well, especially when you're the main focal point, you can't even tune out.
Right.
You know, like if someone's talking to you and it's a conversation you're not into, you can kind of tune out. But when you're the main focal point, yeah. There is no...
Everyone I was talking to was an interview for the show,
yeah.
You know, so I couldn't do that. And then I'm also, as a producer, I'm making, you know, production decisions too. So when I'm not on camera, I'm doing that stuff. And it was just a rough, like I said, I mean, not complaining, but as far as what it was like, I don't know if I would do it again.
Yeah.
You know, it was so exhausting. And then the travel. So we were split between our main two filming places were LA and Memphis. And I was in both places every week during time. And because the schedule had me going home, you know, for a week here and there, I would think I was home for 3 weeks throughout the whole process. Yeah. One of those weeks, we happened to already have a trip planned to go on the Beachbody cruise. So I still wasn't home, which never would you think I'd be upset to go on a cruise. I was like, motherfucker, all I want to do is just be home in my bed with my wife and my kids and my dogs.
Yeah.
And I got one of them. I got the wife with me.
I don't want to think at all. I don't want to do anything and sit around.
Yeah. And I got to do that on the cruise, but I just wasn't home. You know, yeah. It'd been so long since I was
And you
home.
Had a weird incident coming off the cruise too.
Yeah. And that made things really hard. I got that, what they call it, mal disembark syndrome, I think they call it, where I essentially your brain adjusts. We had some rough seas. Your brain adjusts to the ship moving so you don't get sick on the ship. But then when you get off, your brain thinks it's still moving and it makes the world move.
Wow. That's got to be weird.
Yeah. It was terrible. For about a week, it was bad. Like, I don't think I'll ever go on a cruise again. And it was just a bad experience for us. And I heard, like, you went on the same cruise.
Yeah. We had a great time.
Right.
With no issues.
Yeah. I mean, not the same. I mean, the same ship, basically, without the bad waters. But, man, it was rough. And I had to go straight from that to, you know, I was home for a night, flew back to L.A., and I was interviewing someone. And the set for that interview was a dark editing bay room.
Okay.
And that's when it's the worst, when you're in a closed space. And I almost threw up. I had to stop in the middle of it. Like, and I've watched footage from that as we're doing our cuts right now. And I'm like, oh, you're fucked up. Like, your eyes are going crossed and you're in rough shape. But yeah, it was so, but the travel was rough too. I got a lot of frequent flyer miles.
That's good though.
You know, cause it was like, go from here to LA and you know, so like my rest days where we weren't filming, my off days were always traveling.
Yeah.
So I'd fly, it's a 4.5 hour flight to here to LA. Well, that's from Chicago, and I'm connecting somewhere from our little airport, and get out there, stay there for the night, dealing with the jet lag and all that, usually filming the next day. The next day, I'm flying from there to Memphis. I'd fly to Memphis and go to, I usually stayed in an Airbnb there, and I'm still making the podcast this whole time, too.
Yeah.
You know, so all my evenings when I'm not working or working. And so I'd get to Memphis, and then, you know, I my rest day was the day I arrived, and I had enough time to get something to eat and try to write a script for the podcast. And then the next day we're filming. It's all traveling and filming. And then it's back to LA to interview somebody else. And then it's back, you know, a lot of our experts were from that area.
Yeah. I can see the emotional drain. I mean, that's exhausting.
It was rough, and not seeing my kids and not seeing my wife and not seeing my dogs, you know, it was just, it tore me down. I said, they got me tearing up on film more than I'd like. You know, I'm an emotional guy anyway, but some of the time there are moments where normally something might hit that emotional center in my heart and brain and will choke me up, but I could stop it.
Yeah.
You know, I could choke up for a minute, give me a second. I mean, I'm talking sniffling, can't catch my breath. Like it was bad. And I was just a wreck. I was an absolute physical and emotional wreck. By the time the thing was over, to the point where I remember, like, the last day of filming, I was just exhausted. And it's like, okay, I had to go back to do, we call them pickups, right? So we
okay.
because we film everything, and, you know, we got hundreds of hours of footage. They're cutting it down to 4 hours, and they edit everything, and then they run it by the other partners. They run it by the network, and they're like, I want it to look a little different. I want it kind of like this. So we're going to go back up and film these, which is a real nightmare, too. I couldn't change my hair or beard.
Oh, yeah. We talked about that.
Yeah, because everything has to flow, right? So I go back, and I need to film 30 seconds of an interview I was doing with Jim Clemente, right? Yeah. So I got to put on the same outfit, and my hair the same. He's got to put on the same outfit, sit in the exact same. I mean, everything from my coffee cup. He had the gray coffee cup. It was sitting here, sitting there. He had his notepad out. It was turned to this page, and everything had to be right there. And just for me to be like, well, actually, Jim, I think that blah, blah, blah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it would be that crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know we talked about it at one point, because at one point you were discussing getting a new tattoo, and it kind of came up there like, oh, shit, I can't do that yet.
I still can't get it. I mean, I think we're done.
Yeah.
But I just got an order last night. I got to do some more VOs, voiceovers. You know, because what happens is there's little things like from the network.
Yeah.
So, we don't edit down actual interviews with people, but there's like my narration and me talking to camera and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, the network might look at something and you know, their legal might look at it and be like, that might get us sued. Can you rephrase it like this? And so I got to put on my little PDR and all that. And I'll turn around and be like, well, I think that maybe he's involved. you know, but that's hard too, because they're blending that into another scene.
Yeah. And if you're not careful, it definitely sounds like you did it differently.
Right. And I have to match. So I always, it'll be like a 3-sentence line that I need to say, but I'll say it 15 times. They'll send me a little video link.
Yeah.
That'll show, which is what you've seen, some of those short little video links they've sent. And it'll say, it's fitting into this scene right here. So you need to listen to how you're talking, listen to your emotional tone, listen to everything, and then try and make it so that we can blend it right back in there.
Man, that's tough.
And then so I'll do it over and over and over and over. And Mike's always sitting here when I'm doing it. He's like, you sound like a fucking crazy person going over and over and over again. But that last day of filming, man, I remember it was just like, I don't want to do it. I was so, that first day, I'm like, I'm going to make a TV show. Here we go. Give me that makeup. Let's make a TV show. And then last day is like, motherfucker.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, we'll see when it's, I know at the end of it, I was like, I don't. Because honestly, the money is nothing. I mean, it's not nothing. I shouldn't say that. It's not nothing, but it's less than I make on the podcast.
Yeah.
You know, it's unscripted TV for somebody who's never been on unscripted TV before is not very much money at all.
Well, and they're just selling it to you as an excitement thing. Like, you've never been on TV. Here you go.
Right. I probably did better than a lot of people because I didn't care.
Yeah.
I mean, in our negotiations, literally, they're like, my agent's like, well, they're saying this, and that's their bottom line. I said, okay, well, then tell them never mind.
Yeah.
I'm like, and they're like, well, are you really willing to walk away? I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm still not sure I want to do this. Like, yeah. So if that's what walks. So I got a decent deal, but.
You know, and it's funny because as a person that knows you, you know, knows you in real life, knows you as outside of all of this, I've seen the change. I've watched the change, you know, not necessarily changing you, but your change in excitement level. Where at the beginning, you know, you would call me and text me and you're like, yeah, this is happening. This is how it's going to go down.
Right. Right.
And then as the process went, I could see the roller coaster coming to an end
out of my eyes. Yeah. And it's such a first world white privilege fucking problem to bitch about. And I don't mean to be, I kind of feel like I was bitching to the whole thing, but I mean, I got to experience some awesome things, but I just, you know, the reality of it is that, man, it's hard. It's hard. I have a new appreciation for everyone that works in that industry.
Yeah.
Because that's the way I looked at it. It's like, they make all this money and they pop on camera for a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's a fucking grind for everyone involved and it was more so with me because I was the talent and the executive producer. So I had to do kind of two roles. I was, you know, not so much in the production side, but part of it. But man, the PAs, the production assistants, which is kind of where most people start in the film world. You know, a lot of those guys are, you know, they went to school for writing, for production. They all have bigger aspirations, but it doesn't matter. You start as a PA and you work your way up. But man, those people work their butts off. The equipment, you know, when I'm finally done shooting at the end of the day and I get to go back to my hotel and breathe for a minute, they've got to haul all that equipment into a truck and then drive the trucks back to the hotel and then haul it all out of the trucks and into the storage room in the hotel. And
that's all on the clock too, right?
Yeah. So that's built into their hours.
Wow. So then that cuts down your hours too.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Because you got to account for that because you can't, if their 12 hours is up at, you know, say 6 p.m. or, you know, usually it was more like 7 p.m. You can't stop filming at 7. You got to stop filming at 5:30 because they have to have time to break everything down, get it into the trucks and drive it there and unload it before you can finally do the crew call that they're done for the night.
Yeah.
Or you're paying them overtime and stuff. So that, but those guys work so hard. The PAs, the people that never get their, you know, they get a little blip on a credit, you know, they,
yeah, it goes by real quick.
Yeah, real quick. Those are the guys that are working their ever loving asses off on those scenes. And it's so like I mentioned earlier, lady named Megan.
Yeah.
That was our, I think her title was production coordinator. She's the one who always did my makeup.
Okay.
But that wasn't her only job. It just happened to be, she was a person that's good at makeup. So she did my makeup, which by the way, assholes, yeah, all it is a little powder. So I don't shine in the camera. They're not doing actual makeup. I just realized I kept saying makeup.
No, you were getting a makeup.
Yeah. But that's what they have to do. You have to make sure that, you know, the lights, all those lights are putting up aren't making your forehead shine.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that. But man, she was on point. She had everything I needed. So you mentioned I had a cough.
Yeah.
So I had this lingering cough for weeks and I couldn't kick it because I was fucking talking all the time. I couldn't take a break because I was doing interviews. And she's like, you know, lemon tea with honey in it will help. That woman had a hot cup of lemon tea with honey in it in my hands literally every time the cameras cut for 3 weeks straight.
Oh, wow.
Just try to stop me from coughing because it would fuck everything up when I was in an interview. Because if I got a coughing fit, we had to start over. And if I was interviewing, say, a witness or a suspect or something, you know, I can't tell them, hey, can you re-say that? Because I'm coughing.
Yeah.
So I'd have to sit there and like, and every time we'd cut you right here, like, here, Bob, here's your tea. Here's that. Let me touch up your makeup. And let me, you know, here's some Ricolas. And she'd unwrap them for me and have them sitting there.
So she was kind of like the unsung hero.
Yeah. And there's so many people like that on a TV set. I had no idea.
Yeah.
That work so fucking hard. I mean, she was everything from when they picked out that shirt for me that they wanted me to wear in my interviews. You know, I get that all set up, and then we get there, and Downey's like, I don't like the bare chest. I think we want an undershirt. What kind of undershirt? And I had like a black under. I don't like the black. I don't. The her and the camera lady, and didn't like the black. We need a gray. We need, you know. So there's Megan flying to Target to go buy a whole row of undershirts of different colors for me to try on. And then running them all back to, you know, take back what we're not using.
Yeah.
There's just a lot of people that do a lot of work. So there's definitely people that work a lot harder than me. For me personally, it's just very, it becomes physically exhausting to be mentally engaged.
Okay.
For that long.
That makes sense.
Yeah. When I can't just shut it off and I'm just.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
You know, because there's a lot of wait time too. There's a lot for me. Like if they're setting up cameras for 2 hours. There's, you know, I'm not on camera. I got a minute to wait, but then I'm like reading through what we call our beat sheets. Like, you know, so the kind of like, again, like what you see up here, I'm getting ready to do an interview actually tonight in about 45 minutes when we're done with this. And I know what parts of the story that I need this guy to tell.
Okay. So you have to work him into that location of the story.
Right. Yeah. So I have to ask him very specific questions, you know, okay. You know, like for the, well, this will come on after season one. So it'll be like, I need this. This is a guy that went to school with Billy Little, the victim in this case.
Yep.
And so I need to ask him like, what was it like, you know, what was Billy like in high school? I know that's in my beats. It's up there. I need that bite.
Okay.
Whatever the answer is, I need that in there. So Christina would put together these beat sheets, but it's not like that. You know, they're, you know, I'm sitting down to interview someone and here's 5 pages of shit that we need to cover.
Oh, Jesus.
And you got to kind of memorize them and so you don't have to, anyway. But I'd be reading those and stuff. But I think the hardest thing was just the physical exhaustion and surprisingly the emotional exhaustion.
Yeah.
I didn't think it would bother me that much to be away from home for that long. But it was tough. It was hard. And it was, and I could not wait to get back home. And just, it's honestly, I think, helped my relationship with my kids, my family. Not that it was ever bad, but
yeah,
when you have 4 kids, and any of you listening out there that have 4 kids, no, and even with 2 kids, you know.
I have 2 kids.
So. Fucking kids will wear your ass out.
Oh, they sure will.
Yeah. Especially, you know, we got 3 boys, and boys are idiots.
Yeah.
And of course, one, my Princess Bella, as she calls herself. She's got her own different set of attitude. But they just kind of, you know, they wear you out, and they're just, you know, they're in your face all the time, and you're just, you, and you're around them all, you know, all every day, and you're just like, I need a minute, like, get the hell out of here, go stare at your iPad, go do something, just get out of my face, I need a minute. And I think that being gone for that amount of time, it increased my patience.
Okay.
I think with the kids, I mean, I don't mean to say that I was, you see me around my kids. I'm not pushing them off all the time and stuff, but I mean, they just wear you out sometimes. Where now, since I've been back, I'm much more inclined to just sit down. And, you know, before I came out here today, you know, there was Jackson, our 18-year-old, and Quentin, my 14-year-old, and their buddy were sitting there just talking about some ridiculous, stupid shit they're doing on Instagram, which normally I'm out.
Yeah.
Right. Now, I would tell them something like, you guys are idiots. I can get out of the room. I can't stand to listen to your stupidity. But like now I'm much more inclined. I sat in there with a half hour and was joking around. I still call them idiots, but I sat with them and joked around. I appreciate that time.
It's definitely easier to engage now that you've had that time away.
Yeah. You just appreciate it a little bit more. Or I do appreciate it a little bit more.
Yeah.
Like I said, I mean, I would be brought to tears over nothing. There's two or three times I can think of during my interviews where I lost it over weird time. You know, there was other times where I should have lost it.
Yeah.
There was a particular person that I was interviewing that got extremely emotional, and they got emotional, which made me emotional, and it made actually the whole crew. I walked out of that interview and just had to walk away.
Yeah.
And it was like standing, and I remember specifically, like, I walked out and I was just walking away. I just needed some fucking air. When I walked out, the whole crew, they call it Video Village, where they have the monitors outside where they can see what's happening on the cameras.
Yeah.
And everybody's wearing, they call IFBs, which are little headphones, so they can hear what's happening.
No, that makes sense.
So there's a whole crew outside watching what's going on. And I came out and the whole crew was sobbing. Grown men are coming over. They're like, oh my God. It was so rough. You know, like, that was understandable. But like me saying that Ed Eight missed the birth of his son is emotional. It is hard, but I have told that story 100 times.
Yeah.
It doesn't affect me like that. It shouldn't have affected me to the point. It doesn't normally affect me to the point where, you know, I'm brought to tears and need 5 minutes to get my shit together. I think hopefully people don't mind that, because Dominie thinks they like it, because in those moments, it was moments like that where you're having that emotional kind of breakdown.
Yeah.
And I'm staring into a camera, and all I'm seeing is the million people on the other side of that camera that are going to see this. And all I want to do is get the fuck away from the camera and go crawl into a hole. But I know I can't.
Yeah. But people can feel that it's genuine and see that it's genuine. And that's what will connect you to a viewer. Mm-hmm. Or the same thing with listeners on here is when you have that genuine moment, that really connects people. And people can tell when you're genuine or not.
Right.
When you're just sitting here just bullshitting and you're kind of going off something that's not real, they can tell. They can tell right away.
Yeah, I think so. And that was, you know, and that was it, is I knew our, there was, I can't remember the guy's name, but there was a guy I heard speak a long time ago. He was a former military sniper. And it actually was at a church class I was at.
Okay.
And the guy in his kind of, his message was, I planned this when I was in my right mind type of, he was talking about some like stories he had when he was like moving into there was a plan to get from here to here and take the shot at whatever he was supposed to take the shot at. And it was going to take him 24 hours to crawl through there. And then as he's crawling, there's snakes and bugs and ants biting him. And he's having to go to the bathroom on himself. And he's like, screw it. I'm going to stand up and shoot right now. And he had to keep reminding himself, I planned this. When I'm not in my right mind right now, but I planned this when I was in my right mind, and I always kind of fall back on that in a lot of circumstances. But in that one, like when I wanted to get up and run away from the fucking camera, I remember like when Dominie and I and Christina and Matt, we all sat down and planned out the show. It's like, we want it to be real. We want it to be organic. We want it to be genuine. And if there's emotion, we don't want to force emotion, but if there's emotion, we want people to see it. We want people to feel it. We want people to because the show's called The Forgotten West Memphis 3. And we want people to understand the real torment and hurt and emotion that's involved in this. And so in that moment when I was the one, because I've done, you know, when I'm interviewing people, you know, I give them that, you know, when something that Dominie had to teach me, because just as a, you know, a kind human, if someone's starting to get really overwhelmed emotionally, I want to help them, you know, change the subject, bring them out of it, you know, just tell them to take a break. And she's like, you can't, like, the viewers need to see that for that person.
Yeah.
That maybe have whatever view of who that person is. You need to let that ride out, because the viewer needs to see who that person really is.
Yeah.
You know,
and not just their perception of who that is.
Right. And I got that and I did it until it was me. And I'm like, I want to get out of here. But that's why I don't know how much of it'll make the final cut, but you'll see more than me. Cause in those moments, I was like, you got to stick it out. You planned this when you were in your right mind.
Yep.
Just stick it out and let it roll. And Megan would come and we'd cut and bring neat trick, any guys or gals that are ever crying and then don't want people to know you're crying. Because of course my eyelids were all swelled up, is she would take spoons, like metal spoons, and put them in a cup of ice and hold them in and then keep them in there for a few minutes. So the ends of the spoons were like frozen, and then hold the backs of the spoons against my eyes.
Okay.
And it would tame down all the bloodshot and the red and swelling of my eyelids.
All right. So it sounds like I need to carry some spoons around because I get emotional a lot.
You do. You're a big baby.
I am.
You're not a big manly man like me.
I do get emotional a lot. Way more than I should. I do that a lot.
Do you find you get more emotional when you get older? Because like something's wrong with me. I'm so bad now compared to what I used to be.
So this has actually been going on for a while, but ESPN, like on SportsCenter, has a featured segment called My Wish, and it's always these stories, and I cry every single one of them. I cry. And Michelle's here it comes.
I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing with you because I just turned 40, and I've always been an emotional guy.
Yeah.
But let me ask you this. Are those happy, triumphant type stories? Or are they all sad stories?
It's both.
Both, and they both get you.
Yeah, they both get me.
I'm the same way, but what gets me more are those triumphant moments.
Yeah.
You know, obviously sadness gets me and stuff, mm-hmm. but, you know, I just have buddies, our mutual friend, that got married a couple weeks ago. I'm watching the wedding, and it's a fun wedding, and they're just awesome people, and you know, I've known Richie for a long time, and known Lindsay, and like when they're saying I do, and they're holding their arms up, and they did it.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm just tearing up out of just happiness for them. I'm like, what is wrong with you?
Yeah.
Like I wasn't like bawling, but I'm getting teared up and emotional.
Yeah.
Over my friends getting married. That's a good thing, but that stuff affects me so much so that I struggle with public speaking now.
Yeah.
Which was always kind of a strong, I love doing. I went to the UK and did those speeches all around, but I broke down just about every time then. It's like, which, you know, that's a neat trick once, but at some point you got to get your words out.
For me, I mean, moments of happiness get me, but for me, it's almost more the moments of perseverance where it is that happy moment, but it's that person that fell so hard to come back. It's not just something good. You know what I mean? Like sometimes something good will just get me, but it's those moments of...
Well, that's what I meant, kind of that triumphant, same type of thing where it's like, you know, somebody against all odds does something, which I would always be like, yeah, you know, you're cheering for that person. And now I'm freaking weeping for them all. And it happens to me all the time. So maybe it's an old age thing. Maybe we're lacking in free testosterone.
That could be.
Maybe that might explain, you know, I've heard that could explain this 24-pound weight gain. But that really gets to me, dude. That was a bitch.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize it was happening. I interviewed one of the victim's brothers. And I've known him for a little while. We've talked for a little bit, and we're close enough that we can shoot the shit together. And I walked in. It was one of the later interviews I filmed, and I walked in, and he's like, "Whoo, you getting fat, boy?" I was like, "You first of all, fuck you, you son of a bitch." But you know, he's just that type of guy. He's gonna call it like it is. And I didn't, you know, I wasn't noticing that my shirt that I was wearing at the beginning of production don't fit the same as they were fitting at the end of production.
Yeah.
But it was like that moment. I went back to the hotel room. I'm looking. I'm like, motherfucker, this shirt was loose on me when we started. It was weird as I wasn't even eating anything terrible.
Yeah.
I think it was more to do with the lack of sleep and lack of moving.
Yeah.
You know, sitting around so much and not moving. But it definitely physically took a toll on me in the opening act, the first act. So any of you guys watch the show, in the first act... Look at the difference. There's several different scenes in that act. Look at the difference in my face, my complexion, my color of my skin.
Yeah.
From those. Because I can look at it and see, oh, that was the very first interview I shot.
Yeah. And you're probably all sparkly clean and looking good. And
like my face looked thinner. I didn't have circles under my eyes. My color looked good. And then like the next scene, which was, you know, they're kind of shot out of order.
Yeah.
A lot of them just because you have to. And it's like, ugh, you look pale. You have circles under your eyes. Your face looks swollen. You just look so bad. The funny part, and here's a little trick for you when you're watching I don't know if I should say this because it may ruin the show for you, but I've watched a lot of the cuts. The scenes I was talking about when we're doing the interview, and you'll see it when I'm wearing this blue shirt, sitting there talking to the camera.
Okay.
I'm supposed to keep my hair and facial hair all the same. Like, normally I shave my, not completely off, but shave my beard pretty damn close in the summer.
Yeah.
But as you see, I'm just growing it out right now because I'm just, I know as soon as I shave it, they're going to tell me I got to come back. But the problem is, I was traveling all over the place. I couldn't go to my barber here. So I'm going to different barbers all over the place, getting my hair cut, trying to match it. It's never the same. And it's so funny for me to watch, you know, because we filmed in that room like 8 times. And some of the last couple times were pickups, right? Where like I had said something in an earlier one. They're like, oh, we need you to rephrase that. And so I reset it. And so it'd be in the middle of it. And if you watch closely, you can watch my hair change. Like, almost, it'll be like me talking and it cuts to B-roll for a second, cut back to me still talking.
Yeah.
And it'll be like, I've got a little hair on the side, then I got the white walls, then I got the hair and the white walls. And just like, you know, the white walls, meaning the side of my head is completely shaved.
You see that in movies a lot too, where somebody's, you know, a female actress's hair will be over her shoulder and then it'll cut away from her and cut back and it's like behind her and, you know.
Right. Yeah. And so it's funny in that scene because it's supposed to, we put everything we could into making that look. I those clothes Dominique held at knife point, I think, because everything had to be exactly the same. We had two of the shirts in case something happened, which one time something did. I splashed water on my shirt when I was washing my hands in the bathroom, so then she wouldn't let me wear my shirt into the bathroom anymore.
That's funny.
But it was when we were done with that, they would take them and Megan would go dry clean them, and then they would keep them hidden, locked away somewhere to make sure we had that exact shirt to look the same every time.
That's funny.
But yeah, it was a hell of an experience for sure, and I'm glad I did it. I'm glad I experienced it.
Yeah. I think it's really neat to hear all of this too, because I wouldn't have expected any of this. Like, I didn't know what went into making a show, but I would never have expected it was as in depth and had all these layers that it takes to actually get this thing going.
Yeah, it's neat. There's a lot going on, and definitely every time you watch any kind of, especially, I don't know. I mean, I only know my experience was unscripted TV.
Yeah,
any of those shows. There's so much more work that goes in. Little things like I was watching Storage Wars in the hotel the other night, and you know they showed where they picked up something, you know, that they found in a storage locker, and he's like, oh, look at this, CDs, and then it cuts to his hand opening the CD. That shit's all that dude. They filmed organically him opening it, and then after he was done, and you feel like you're finally done, then they go back and do what they call cutaways, which is what that is. And they'll go back and they'll look like we're in. They'll like, okay, hold the CD. Now we need to put a camera on your hand. Now open the CD again. Now let's get it from a different angle. Open the CD again.
Yeah.
Open the CD again. Open the CD again. Right. For me, it was a lot of like writing right on the paper, right on the paper. You know, they got me writing on the paper from across the room. And now they need it from 5 other angles up close with me writing on the paper over and over and over again. It's just a lot that goes into it.
So for people that know me, I know I've had a lot of friends that have been on Ink Master, and I've heard that too. They'll walk in the room 5 times. You know, they'll do all these things where you don't, it doesn't look like that on TV, but.
Right. The walk-ins are so walk bad.
In, nope, turn around, go back, do it again. Mm-hmm. All right, let's do it again.
That's the one thing that is fake, I think, in most shows, which is the walk-in introductions.
Yeah.
And I hate them because none of us are actors. You'll see it a couple times, me and Jim, like, hey, Jim, how you doing? Good to see you. Thanks for meeting me. Oh, it's good to meet with you again, Bob. We've been talking for 2 hours in the hallway getting ready to start the scene, but they always want those shots.
Those shots, yep. So for anybody that wants to see this show, when are they going to be able to see it?
I don't know for sure.
Great answer.
Yeah. I would tell you if I knew. So the process is, so once we finish filming, as I mentioned, then the editors do the cuts, and then we review it in-house, and then when we get the way we like it, we send it to the network. The network notes it, sends it back, they recut it, they send it again, and then they note it again, and then we recut it. Right now, we've sent in what we call lock cuts for all the episodes.
Okay.
But they're not lock cuts because they just sent me another VO request, as I said, so there must be new. So then the next step is legal comes through and says, are we going to get sued? What do we need to change? And that's all happening now. The finished product will be in the hands of the network probably by the time this episode drops.
Excellent.
So then it's up to the network when they air it. I don't know, honestly. They originally said, first quarter of 2020, but that was when they wanted an October delivery.
Yeah.
And then we moved it up and all of a sudden started in February. So now we're looking at a July delivery when it's done. So, I mean, I would suspect probably fall, late summer, fall, winter. I don't know.
Yep.
But I know for sure they had a spot carved out for it in like January
okay.
of this year, of next year. But I would guess it'll be before that.
And what networks is it going to be on?
It's going to be on Oxygen.
All right. And what's the name of the show?
As of right now, it was going to be The Truth and Justice, The West Memphis 3. Now it's Truth and Justice, The Forgotten West Memphis 3.
Okay. Which I think is really cool.
Which, yeah, that was my vote the whole time.
So you guys have heard it here. It might change between now and then, but you've heard it here. So make sure you guys tune in when it comes out.
Yeah. And then let Zach know what you think.
Yeah,
absolutely. And Zach, have you told your audience that you're going to hop into a new venture?
I have not told my audience that yet.
We just made the decision sort of like right before we started recording.
Yep. So that I will be at least tentatively joining the Truth and Justice Army for the Friday follow-ups every week for this new season, which is season 7.
Yep. We had Zach on last week as we need to throw something together. And with the season finales, we don't have a lot of questions.
Yep.
So we thought, well, we'll bring Zach in. Zach's a listener. He knows what's going on and we'll just chat about it. And I personally, as a consumer of podcasts, when I listen back to them, like, I love this free form flowing conversation.
I do too. That's much more what I'd rather listen to.
Yeah. And so I threw it out to the audience. They seem really excited about it. So yeah, Zach is now going to on our Friday follow-ups, at least for now, until everybody gets mad at us. We're gonna have Zach in and be another co-host on the Truth and Justice Friday follow-ups,
which I'm excited for. And if you're listening to this the day that it comes out, you can listen to me and Bob tomorrow.
Oh, that's right, it's next week.
Yep.
Awesome.
Thank you, Bob, for joining me tonight.
Thanks for having me. I guess I'll be sound engineering from over here.
Well, I figured that.
Right. So
it's kind of weird.
Because I've interviewed for several other podcasts from the studio, and I've never given up my seat.
Yeah, it happens. It's not terrible.
You have to pee?
No.
Oh, your body language was telling me you looked like you have to pee. Nope. Jim Clementi taught me that.
Don't tell people that he was wrong on that one.
Right. Yeah, or I'm just wrong on that. Yeah.